his instructions? Why did he leave his post? Did it not occur to Parker that by doing so he was jeopardizing the president's life? Unquote. As Winkler added, such questions apparently were never asked, and the participants never commented on them. No one seemed to want to set the record straight. Keep in mind that that lengthy list of questions only covers one small aspect of the events of that day. There are literally hundreds of unanswered and frequently unasked questions still surrounding the Lincoln assassination. As one further example, there is the question of how it was that in at least a half a dozen isolated pockets of the country, news of Lincoln's assassination was reported 4 to 12 hours before the Lincolns had arrived at Ford's Theater. Folks in St. Joseph, Minnesota, which was 40 miles from the nearest railroad and 80 miles from the nearest telegraph service, learned of Lincoln's death while he was still very much alive. So did the good people of Manchester, New Hampshire, and the people living in Middleton, New York, and in Newburgh, New York, as well. Ace reporters at the Whig press got the scoop before the shot was fired. Maybe they had caught wind of the fact that a couple of weeks before the assassination, Mary Todd Lincoln, who was known to go on extravagant shopping sprees, had purchased some $25,000 worth of mourning clothing. It's always good to be prepared, even when your husband isn't even ill, let alone dying. And that brings us to an end of part 10 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong. As always, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, click on the Features tab, and jump down to Lincoln to pick up with us next time in Part 11. Thanks for joining me, guys. My name is Mark. You've been listening to the Pure Grace Podcast. Thanks again for joining me, guys. And as always, we look forward to catching you next time. Take care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to jump into Part 11 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong by David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com. Click on the Features tab and jump down to Lincoln and pick up with us right here in Part 11. Let's jump right in. When we left off on the last outing, two men officially identified as John Wilkes Booth and David Harold just crossed the Navy Yard Bridge from Washington, D.C. into Maryland. They were the only two people to cross the bridge after curfew that fateful night, so being allowed to do so was quite the lucky break for the pair. Just as it had been a lucky break for Booth that Lincoln's bodyguard for the evening, John Parker, had abandoned his post, as had coachman Francis Burns and presidential aide Charles Forbes, all three of whom went next door to drink in the same bar as John Wilkes Booth, and that General Grant and his military entourage had not accompanied the Lincoln Party to the theater. Booth caught numerous lucky breaks that night, like having the telegraph service go down right after the assassination, but as Thomas Eckert later explained to a congressional committee, that apparently was a trivial matter. Quote, it didn't seem at the time sufficiently important, as the interruption only continued about 2 hours. I was so full of business of almost every character that I could not give it my personal attention. I could not ascertain with certainty what the facts were without making a personal investigation, and I had not time to do that. For those who may have forgotten, Eckert was hired specifically to set up and maintain the telegraph system, which naturally raises the question of what other more important, quote, business of every character he had to attend to on a night when keeping the system running should have been, one would think, of uttermost importance. Leonard Guttridge and Ray Neff have written in The Dark Union that Booth caught another lucky break when, at the same time that the telegraph system mysteriously went down, someone at the gasworks on Maryland Avenue shut off the gas that fed the lights around the Capitol and westward along Pennsylvania Avenue, plunging the assassin's escape route into darkness at a most opportune time. Booth also caught a lucky break when his questionable choice of a firearm turned out to be surprisingly adequate for the job. He took a huge risk, as it will be recalled, in bringing a single-shot Derringer as his only firearm. The risk was, as James Swanson noted in Manhunt, completely unnecessary. Quote, Booth couldn't have chosen the Derringer because he could not obtain a revolver. He had already purchased at least four, and if he did not have any in his hotel room within easy reach, he could have gone out and bought another one. In the war capital of the Union, thousands of guns, including small, lightweight, pocket-sized revolvers, were for sale in the shops of Washington. Another lucky break for Booth was that the locks on both of the doors leading into the presidential box at Ford's Theater were conveniently broken, rendering them useless, and a spy hole had been drilled into one of them at eye level so that someone approaching could survey the scene inside the booth before entering. Both of those anomalies were apparently unnoticed by Lincoln and his not very security-oriented entourage. And as previously discussed, a heavy piece of lumber precisely long enough to wedge the door shut happened to be on hand. Many historians have claimed that Booth himself had come by earlier in the day and broken the locks, drilled the hole, and fashioned a hidden wedge for the door, but no evidence to support such claims has ever been presented. Booth also caught a lucky break in that he was able to successfully execute an unlikely and extremely risky escape from a crowded theater. As no less a scholar than Bill O'Reilly has had written for him, quote, "A less informed man might worry about being trapped in a building with a limited number of exits, no windows, and a crowd of witnesses, many of them able-bodied men just back from the war." Donald Winkler was a bit more blunt in his assessment, quote, "It sounded like a foolhardy plan with no chance of success. How could one man with a single-shot derringer, a bullet, and a knife walk nonchalantly through a crowded theater, pass unobstructed through two doors into a state box, stand behind the president without being seen by the two occupants in the box, kill the president with no one hearing the sound of the shot, leap 11 feet to the stage, take time to yell a message to the audience, and escape through a rear exit? Fulfilling this mission required far more than blind luck. Actually, there were obviously more than two occupants in the box, and plenty of people heard the shot, but such glaring errors are commonplace in the existing literature on the assassination." So having caught numerous lucky breaks, Booth and Harold rode off separately into the Maryland night, with Booth having a lead on Harold. No mention is ever made of Y. Powell, who had supposedly attacked the Seward family, and Azarote, who was supposed to have killed second-in-command Andrew Johnson, were not included in the escape plan. In any event, Booth and Harold supposedly met up 8 miles from the city limits. How they did so in the dark with no communication devices is anyone's guess. No mention is made in the literature of Booth asking Harold anything about how the alleged attack at the Seward mansion had gone down, or about the attack on Johnson that had supposedly been planned, or about what had become of Powell and Azarote. The pair's first stop, so the story goes, was at Mary Surratt's tavern in Surrattsville, run by John Lloyd. They allegedly arrived there around midnight. Lloyd, known as a raging drunkard, allegedly supplied the pair with 2 carbines, field glasses, and booze. By many accounts, his confession to such high crimes was obtained through torture, and it is never explained why the pair wouldn't have already had those items and various other provisions from the outset. Lloyd became a witness for the prosecution at the pseudo-trial of the conspirators. Of course, his other option was certain conviction and probable execution, so he was highly motivated to tell the story the government wanted him to tell. The pair's next stop, at about 4:30 in the morning on April 15, 1865, with Lincoln still clinging to life, was at the home of Dr. Samuel Mudd, who gained the dubious distinction of being the only person along Booth's alleged escape route to be prosecuted and convicted. Wanted posters issued by Secretary of War Edwin Stanton warned that, quote, "All persons harboring or secreting the conspirators or aiding their concealment or escape will be treated as accomplices in the murder of the president and shall be subject to trial before a military commission and the punishment of death." As we shall see, though, various historians have identified at least 2 dozen people who supposedly provided aid and comfort to the fugitives, and none of them, other than Mudd, were ever prosecuted for their alleged crimes, and all of their names are now long forgotten. Booth and Harold supposedly introduced themselves to Mudd using the aliases of Tyson and Henson, and by some accounts, Booth wore a fake beard, which of course makes perfect sense since Booth had chosen not to don a disguise before committing the crime and had left his real name scattered about the crime scene and the escape route. And by virtually all accounts, Mudd knew Booth and had prior dealings with him, so the good doctor would have surely seen through a cheap disguise. For the record, Mudd claimed that he did not recognize the man that he treated as John Wilkes Booth, and he could not identify David Harold from a photograph. Harold, meanwhile, maintained that he had crossed the bridge out of Washington on the afternoon of April 14th and was long gone from the city when Lincoln was shot. He also claimed that he had not gone to the Mudd house with Booth or anyone else. And evidence does indeed suggest that Harold spent the afternoon of April 14th on a horseback ride in the Maryland countryside, and he did so with, and I couldn't possibly make this stuff up, a 16-year-old kid by the name of Johnny Booth, who was apparently not related to the far more famous John Booth. Harold and the young Booth got drunk and passed out and were found the next morning by Johnny's father. Johnny and his father, of course, were not called upon to testify at the mock trial. Meanwhile, Mudd repaired the damage to his visitor's leg, which he later described in a statement as a not very serious or painful wound, and fashioned a splint for him. He then offered the exhausted travelers sleeping accommodations. After catching some sleep and paying the good doctor for his services, the pair left later that day. At the infamous trial of the conspirators, the story did not pick up again until 9 days later on April 24th, when the pair allegedly took a ferry across the Rappahannock River. Various historical narratives have filled in those missing 9 days, though not necessarily with a story that has much credibility. According to Lincoln folklore, a guy by the name of Oswell Swan, sometimes identified as Oswald Swan, described as being half black and half Indian, guided the pair to the home of a Samuel Cox at about 1 a.m. on April 16, 1865. Cox allegedly advised Booth and Harold to hide out in a nearby pine thicket and had his overseer, Franklin Roby, guide them there. He then summoned Thomas Jones to supply them with food, blankets, and newspapers. Needless to say, none of these men were ever prosecuted for their alleged capital offenses. Booth and Harold supposedly spent 5 long days cooling their heels in that pine thicket. During that time, they had to keep quiet at all times for fear of alerting any nearby patrols to their whereabouts. They couldn't light a fire to keep warm, and Booth is generally described as being immobilized and in considerable pain from his injury, the one that Dr. Mudd described as not being particularly painful. According to the best-selling Manhunt, for example, quote, Booth never rose from the ground during the time in the thicket. So the wealthy, accomplished, well-bred actor spent 5 agonizing days lying hungry and motionless on the cold, unforgiving ground of a Maryland pine thicket. Sounds perfectly reasonable. One problem with that tall tale, though, concerns the fate of both Booth and Harold's horses. It is agreed that they had surely had horses when they arrived at the pine thicket, and they would have had to get rid of them to avoid giving away their position to any passing patrols. So what happened to them? In Manhunt, James Swanson tells the following tale. Quote, Davy Harold untied both horses and led them by the reins to a quicksand morass about a mile from the pine thicket. Quickly, he shot each one in the head with a pistol or the carbine and sank their bodies, still accoutred with the saddles, bits, bridles, stirrups, and all, and they rest in an unmarked grave, their skeletons undiscovered to this day. Here, Swanson has acknowledged something that historians agree on. Despite one of the world's most exhaustive manhunts, no trace of the two horses was ever found. According to the guy who actually writes the books that Bill O'Reilly puts his name on, quote, a combined force of 700 Illinois cavalry, 600 members of the 22nd Colored Troops, and 100 men from the 16th New York Cavalry Regiment now enter the wilderness of Maryland's vast swamps on April 18, 1865. Incredibly, 87 of these brave men will drown in their painstaking week-long search for the killers. No large animal carcasses were ever found on that search or on any other searches. O'Reilly doesn't mention, by the way, of how many of those 87 alleged drowning deaths included members of the 22nd Colored Troops. Historians also agree that Booth was far too seriously injured to be of any help to Harold, leaving Harold solely responsible for disposing of the horses. There are, generally speaking, 2 versions of the story of the disappearing horses, both of which are laughably absurd. One commonly told fable holds that Harold led the two horses into quicksand. The other posits that he shot and buried them. Swanson has essentially weaved a new version of the tall tale by combining the two. Some historians just avoid any mention of the disappearing horses trick, probably out of a desire to not sound like buffoons, but others have no problem with repeating tales that have stood unchallenged for well over a century, despite being easily discredited. Because the reality, dear readers, is that there is no rational explanation for how 2 horses and all the gear accompanying them would have just vanished into thin air. Only in some fantasy world, where it would be possible for one man working alone in fairly primitive conditions and with no tools at his disposal, to dig graves deep enough to completely conceal 2 very large animal carcasses without even leaving mounds for searchers to find. And even if he could somehow dig the holes, how would one man get those very heavy carcasses into those miraculously excavated graves? And wouldn't shooting them be a very risky maneuver since gunshots tend to attract attention? It seems rather unlikely, then, that Harold shot the horses and then buried them both with his bare hands. Equally preposterous is the claim that Harold led the horses into quicksand and let them sink to their deaths. Horses can be rather obedient creatures, to be sure, but they certainly aren't stupid, and they won't willingly walk into what they would surely perceive as a death trap. And how exactly would someone go about leading them into quicksand? Wouldn't that require that the person doing the leading would have to walk out into the quicksand ahead of the horses? Those are rather moot points, though, given that Wikipedia describes quicksand as harmless and notes that, quote, people falling into and unrealistically being submerged in quicksand or a similar substance is a trope of adventure fiction, notably in movies. It doesn't actually happen, you see, in real life, but that hasn't stopped mainstream historians and academics from promoting such nonsense for decades. As previously noted, Swanson has combined the 2 versions of the disappearing horses fable. No graves needed to be dug because the bodies were disposed of in quicksand, though horse-swallowing quicksand pits only exist in movies and TV shows from the 1960s and in bestsellers that begin with these words, quote, this story is true. And in this particular version of the fable, Harold didn't have to lead the horses into the mythical quicksand, he just led them to it. But what Swanson leaves out is an explanation of how Harold single-handedly drug or pushed those half-ton horse carcasses into a fictional quicksand pit. The only way that could actually happen is in a cartoon. In any event, after allegedly spending 5 long days lounging in a Maryland pine thicket, our anti-heroes supposedly emerged to attempt a crossing of the Potomac River in a boat supplied by local fisherman Henry Rowland. Their first attempt, though, failed when the pair couldn't row straight and supposedly paddled the wrong direction and ended up in Nanjemoy Creek, still on the Maryland side of the Potomac. Not to worry, though, they went to a farm owned by Peregrine Davis and operated by his son-in-law, John Hughes, who happily put his life on the line by feeding and sheltering the fugitives. The next night, April 21st, Booth and Harold chose not to attempt a second crossing of the Potomac. For reasons never explained by historians, it had been a full week since the assassination, and the most wanted men in America had failed to put much distance at all between themselves and Washington. But they apparently weren't in any hurry. The dynamic duo allegedly made a second attempt the next night and successfully navigated into Macadoak Creek, near the home of Elizabeth Quisenberry. They arrived at Quisenberry's home at around 1 p.m. on April 23rd. The lady of the house promptly sent for Thomas Harbin, who was reportedly Thomas Jones' brother-in-law. Harbin arrived about 3 p.m. with 2 horses and 2 associates, William Bryant and Joseph Baden. The 5 men then rode to the home of Dr. Richard Stewart, who was apparently related in some way to General Robert E. Lee. Stewart directed the party, which arrived around 8 p.m., to the cabin of a freed slave by the name of William Lucas, because, you know, freed slaves were highly motivated to assist Lincoln's alleged assassin. From there, Booth and Harold were supposedly transported by son Charlie Lucas to Port Conway, hidden under a load of straw in a wagon. In Port Conway, the fugitive pair hooked up with 3 Confederate soldiers by the name of Mortimer Ruggles, Absalom Bainbridge, and William Jett, who by some accounts had been under the command of notorious Confederate intelligence operative John S. Mosby. Mosby, by the way, would soon enthusiastically campaign and serve in the cabinet of Ulysses S. Grant, the man who had defeated his supposedly beloved Confederacy. Booth, Harold, Ruggles, Jett, and Bainbridge, along with a few horses, purportedly took a ferry across the Rappahannock River. At approximately 3 p.m. on April 24, 1865, they arrived at the Garrett home. The gravely injured, or not so gravely injured, John Wilkes Booth stayed at the home while Harold rode on to Bowling Green with his new friends. Booth spent the night with one of the Garrett sons, while Harold and Bainbridge slept at the home of Joseph and Elizabeth Clark. Harold returned the next day with Ruggles and Bainbridge, though Jett stayed behind in Bowling Green, from where he would soon lead a posse to the Garrett farm. Booth and Harold spent the next night, April 25th, supposedly locked in Garrett's tobacco barn, making them easy prey for the posse that would soon arrive. The Reverend Richard Garrett, however, who was just 11 at the time of the assassination, would later note that the barn actually had double doors on all 4 sides and large windows in the upper story. William H. Garrett would add that some of those doors and windows fastened on the inside. There was, therefore, no way to actually lock the fugitives inside, another unfortunate fact that has been swept aside by historians. The posse that would allegedly end the life of John Wilkes Booth arrived at the Garrett home around 2 a.m. on April 26, 1865. A few hours later, Booth, or someone playing the part of Booth, had been shot. In due time, Dr. Richard Stewart, William Bryant, Elizabeth Quisenberry, Samuel Cox, Thomas Jones, the Garrett sons, and various others were arrested and taken to the old Capitol prison. Curiously, though, they were all freed without being charged, all but Dr. Mudd. Meanwhile, as Booth and Harold were following their convoluted path to the Garrett farm, a massive manhunt spearheaded by Edwin Stanton was underway. And that ends part 11 of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong by David McGowan. As always, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, hit the Features tab, and jump down to Lincoln to pick up with us next time in Part 12, the last installment of this particular series. As always, thank you for joining me. My name is Mark. You've been listening to the Pure Grace Podcast. I look forward to catching you next time. Take care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to jump into Part 12, the final installment of Why Everything We Think We Know About the Lincoln Assassination Is Wrong by David McGowan. As always, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com, click on the Lincoln tab, and pick up with us here in Part 12. I hope that you've enjoyed the series as much as I have. I found it very informative and eye-opening in terms of new information that I'd never heard before, and so I hope that you've enjoyed it and learned some things as well. Let's jump right in. Before resuming where we left off, I need to tack on some info here that should have been included in earlier installments. First off, there were, as it turns out, at least 3 additional suspicious deaths that followed closely on the heels of the Lincoln assassination. So let's take a quick look at those. And as I'm sure it will be recalled, these deaths are in addition to all the other curious deaths and confinements that have previously been discussed. First up for review is Colonel Levi C. Turner, who was appointed assistant judge advocate for the Army on August 5, 1862, which positioned him to be the second in command to Judge Advocate Holt during the farcical trial of the conspirators. The colonel also worked closely with notorious NDP chief Lafayette Baker during and after the Civil War to investigate suspected subversive activities. Turner died of unstated causes on March 13, 1867. Less than 2 years after Lincoln was slain, and about 16 months before Baker himself turned up dead. Also up for review is our old friend Silas Cobb, the guy who was in charge of guarding the Navy Yard Bridge and enforcing the curfew on the night of the assassination. Cobb was the accommodating gentleman who allegedly